He gazed firmly at me, and added, "You must get it quite clear in your mind, Lobsang, that distance means nothing whatever when it comes to telepathy. Telepathy can span oceans, it can even span worlds." I confess that I was most anxious to do more in the realm of telepathy. I could visualize myself talking to those of my fellows who were at other lamasaries, such as Sura, or even in far-off districts. It seemed to me, though, that all my efforts had to be devoted to things which would help me in the future, a future, which, according to all prophecies, would be a gloomy affair indeed. My guide interrupted my thoughts again, "We will go into this matter of telepathy later. We will also go into the matter of clairvoyance, for you will have abnormal powers of clairvoyance, and it will ease things for you if you are aware of the mechanics of the process. It all revolves around brain waves and interrupting the Akashic record, but night is upon us. We must cease our discussion for the moment and prepare for sleep that we may during the night hours be refreshed in time for the first service." He rose to his feet, and I rose to mine. I bowed to him in the attitude of respect, and I wished that I could show more adequately the profound respect which I felt for this great man who had so befriended me. Briefly, a fleeting smile crossed his lips, and he stepped forward and I felt his warm hand clasp upon my shoulder. A gentle pat, and he said, "Good night, Lobsang. We must not delay any longer, or we shall be logheads again, unable to awaken when it is time for us to attend to our devotions." In my own room I stood for some moments by the window with the cold night air blowing in. I gazed out upon the lights of Lhasa, and reflected upon all that had been told to me, and upon all that I had yet to learn. It was obvious to me that the more I learned, the more there was to learn, and I wondered where it would all end. With a sigh, perhaps of despair, I rolled myself more tightly in my robe and lay down upon the cold floor to sleep. Chapter 7. A cold, cold wind was blowing down off the mountains. Dust and small stones whipped through the air and most of them seemed to aim directly for our shrinking bodies. Wise old animals stood with bowed head to wind that their fur should not be disturbed and cause them to lose body heat. We rounded the corner from the Kunduling and turned into the Manulakhang. A sudden blast of air, even fiercer than the others, swept under the robes of one of my companions, and with a howl of fright he was blown up into the air like a kite. We looked up, awestruck, with our mouths open. He appeared to be flying to the city, arms outstretched, robes billowing and making him into giant size. Then there came a lull, and he dropped like a stone into the Kling Chu. We rushed madly to the scene, fearing he would drown. As we reached the bank, he, Yeljai, seemed to be standing knee-deep in the water. The gale shrieked with renewed force, swirling Yeljai around and sweeping him backwards to our arms. Wonder of wonders, he was hardly wet, except from the knees down. We hastened away, holding our robes tightly to us lest we to be blown into the air. Along the Manulakhang we marched. And an easy march it was. The howling gale blew us along. Our only effort was to maintain a vertical position. In the village of Shou, a party of high-ranking ladies were seeking shelter. I always liked to guess at the identity of the person behind the leather face mask. The younger the face painted on the leather, the older the woman who wore it. Tibet is a cruel and harsh country, with screaming winds blowing torrents of stones and sand from the mountains. Men and women often wore masks made of leather as protection from the storms. These masks, with slits for eyes and another slit through which one breathed, were invariably painted with a representation of the wearer's opinion of herself. "Let's go by the street of shops," yelled Timon, striving to make himself heard above the gale. "Waste of time," screamed Yeljai. "They put up the shutters when there is a gale like this. All their stock would be blown away otherwise." We hurried on, going at more than twice our normal pace. Crossing by the turquoise bridge, we had to hold on to each other, the force of the wind was so great. Looking back, we saw that the Potala and Iron Mountain were obscured by a black sullen cloud. A cloud composed of dust particles and small stones worn and torn from the eternal Himalayas. Hurrying on, knowing that the black cloud would overtake us if we were laggardly, We passed the house of Doran just outside the inner circle around the immense Jokang. With a roar, the storm was upon us, beating at our unprotected heads and faces. Timon instinctively raised his hands to protect his eyes. The wind gripped his robe and raised it high over his head, leaving him as bare as a peeled banana, just before the Cathedral of Lhasa. Stones and twigs came bowling down the street towards us, bruising our legs and, at times, drawing blood. The sky became blacker, as dark as night. Hustling Timon before us, struggling with the flapping robe which swirled around his head, we staggered into the sanctuary of the holy place. Inside was peace, profound peace, soothing peace. Here, for some 1300 years, had come the devout to worship. Even the fabric of the building exuded sanctity. The stone floor was ribbed and grooved by the passage of generation after generation of pilgrims. The air felt alive, so much incense had been burned here throughout the ages that it seemed to have endowed the place with a sentient life of its own. Age-blackened pillars and beams loomed through the perpetual dusk. The dull glitter of gold, reflecting the light of butter lamps and candles, did little to bring a lightening of the gloom. The little flickering flames turned the shadows of the sacred figures into a grotesque dance on the temple walls. God cavorted with goddess in a never-ending play of light and shadow as the endless procession of devout pilgrims moved past the lamps. Pinpoints of light of all colors shot forth from the great heaps of jewels. Diamonds, topaz, beryl, rubies and jade flashed forth the light of their nature, forming an ever-changing pattern, a kaleidoscope of color. Great open-work iron nets with links just too small to permit the passage of a hand, guarded the gems and gold from those whose cupidity overcame their rectitude. Here and there, in the brilliant dusk behind the iron curtain, pails of red eyes gleamed, proof that the temple cats were ever on the alert. Incorruptible, unbribable, without fear of man or beast, they padded silently on velvet paws. But those soft feet held sheathed claws of razor sharpness, should their ire be aroused. Of surpassing intelligence, they had but to look at one to know one's intentions. A suspicious move toward the jewels they guarded, and they would become devils incarnate, working in pairs. One would flash at the throat of the would-be thief while the other would cling to his right arm. Only death would loose their grip unless the attending monks came quickly. To me, or to others like me who loved them, the cats would roll and purr, and permit us to play with the priceless gems. Play, but not to take away. All black, with vivid blue eyes which glowed a blood red by reflected light, they were known in other countries as Siamese cats. Here, in cold Tibet, they were all black. In the tropics, they were all white. We wandered around, paying our respects to the golden images. Outside, the storm roared and fumed, blowing away all objects which were unsecured and making hazardous the passage of unwary travelers forced by urgent business to be upon the wind-swept roads. Here, though, in the temple, all was quiet save for the muted shush-shush of many feet as pilgrims did their circuits, and the incessant clack-clack of the ever-turning prayer wheels. But we did not hear them. Day after day, night after night, the wheels went round and round with their clack-clack, 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 until they had become a part of our existence. We heard them no more than we heard our heartbeats or our breath. But there was another sound, a harsh, rasping purr, and the chink of the metal curtain as an old Tom butted his head against it to remind me that he and I were old friends. Idly I pushed my fingers through the links and scratched his head, fingers in greeting, and then with his rough old tongue nearly scraped the skin off with the fervor of his licking. A suspicious movement further down the temple, and he was off like a flash in order to protect his property. "Wish we'd looked at the shops," whispered Timon. "Stupid," whispered Yeljai, "you know they are shut during the storms." "Be quiet, you boys," said a fierce proctor, stepping out of the shadows and aiming a blow which caught poor Timon off balance, and sent him sprawling to the floor. A nearby monk looked disapprovingly at the scene, and twirled his prayer wheel furiously. The great proctor, almost 7 feet tall, stood over us like a human mountain and hissed, "If you boys make another squeak, I'll tear you apart with my hands and toss the pieces to the dogs outside." Now, be quiet. With a last scowl in our direction, he turned and vanished into the shadows. Carefully, afraid of even the rustle of his robes, Timon rose to his feet. We slipped off our sandals and tiptoed to the door. Outside, the storm was still raging. From the mountain pinnacles, pennants of dazzlingly white snow streamed out. From lower reaches, from the Potala and Chakpori, black streams of dust and stones flowed. Along the sacred way, great columns of dust raced into the city. The wind howled and screeched as if even the devils had gone crazy and were playing a mad cacophony without sense or reason. Holding on to each other, we crept southwards round the Jokang, seeking the shelter of an alcove at the back of the council hall. The torrent of turbulent air threatened to lift us from our feet and blow us over the wall into the Tsang Kung nunnery. We shivered at the mere thought, and pressed on to shelter. Our objective attained, we leaned back, our breath coming in great sobs from the efforts we had made, said Timon, "I wish I could put a spell on that proctor. Your honorable guide could do it, Lobsang. Perhaps you could persuade him to turn that into a pig," he added hopefully. I shook my head. "I am sure he would not," I replied, "for the Lama Miniadon Up never does ill to man or beast. Still, it would be nice to have the proctor turn into something else. He was a bully." The storm was abating. Less shrill was the keening of the wind around the eaves. Pebbles previously wind-borne dropped to the roads and clattered against rooftops. Nor did the dust penetrate our robes so much. Tibet is a high and exposed country. Winds piled up behind the mountain ranges and rushed in a fury through the passes, frequently flinging travelers to their deaths in the ravines. Gusts of wind roared through lamasery corridors, sweeping them clean, blowing away dust and litter before emerging to scream through the valley, and onto the open stretches beyond. The clamor and the tumult died. The last of the storm clouds raced across the sky, leaving the vast vault of heaven purple and pure. The harsh glare of the sun beat upon us, dazzling us with its brilliance after the murk and gloom of the storm. With grating creaks, doors were cautiously opened, heads appeared and the damage of the day assessed. Poor old Mrs. Rax, near whose house we stood, had her front windows blown in and her rear windows blown out. In Tibet, windows are of thick oiled paper, oiled so that one may, at some strain to the sight, see out. Glass is rare indeed in Lhasa, paper made from the plentiful willow and rushes is cheap. We set out for home, Chakpori, stopping whenever any item of interest attracted our gaze. "Lobsang," said Timon, "say, the shops will be open now. Come on, it won't take long." So saying, he turned off to the right at a much faster pace. Yeljai and I followed with just the merest show of reluctance. Arrived at the street of shops, we looked eagerly about us. What wonders there were! The all-pervading smell of tea, many types of incense from India and China, jewelry, and things from far-off Germany which were so strange to us as to have no meaning. Further along we came to a shop where sweets were sold, sticky things on sticks, cakes covered with white sugar or colored icing. We looked and longed. As poor chelas, we had no money and so could buy nothing, but to look was free. Yeljai nudged my arm and whispered, "Lobsang, that big fellow, isn't that Tsu who used to look after you?" I turned and stared in the direction where he pointed. Yes. It was Tsu all right, Tsu who had taught me so much and had been so very harsh with me. Instinctively I stepped forward and smiled up at him. "Tsu," I said, "I am underscore." He scowled at me and snarled, "Get away, you boys, don't pester an honest citizen about his master's business. You can't beg from me." He turned abruptly and strode away. I felt my eyes grow hot and feared that I was going to disgrace myself in front of my friends. No, I could not afford the luxury of tears, but Tsu had ignored me, pretended not to know me. Tsu, who had taught me from birth. I thought how he had tried to teach me to ride my pony in Akin, how he had taught me to wrestle. Now he had repudiated me, spurned me. I hung my head and disconsolately scratched the dust with my foot. By me, my two companions stood silent, awkward, feeling as I felt, finding that they too had been slighted. A sudden movement attracted my attention. An elderly bearded Indian, wearing a turban, walked slowly toward me. "Young sir," he said in his queerly accented Tibetan, "I saw all, but think not ill of that man. Some of us have forgotten our childhood. I have not, come with me." He led the way to the shop at which we had so recently gazed. "Let these young men take their pick," he said to the shopkeeper. Shyly each of us took one of those gorgeous sticky things and bowed gratefully to the Indian. "No. No," he exclaimed, "one is not enough, take another each." We did so, and he paid the smiling shopkeeper. "Sir," I said fervently, "may the blessing of Buddha be with you and protect you, may your joys be many." He smiled benignly upon us, bowed slightly, and turned away to continue his business. Slowly we made our way home, slowly eating our sweets in order to make them last as long as possible. We had almost forgotten what such things tasted like. These tasted better than most because they had been given with such good feeling. I reflected, as we walked along, that first my father had ignored me upon the steps of the potala, and now Tsu had ignored me. Yeljai broke the silence. "It's a funny world, Lobsang. Now we are boys, we are ignored and snubbed. When we are lamas, the blackheads will come running for our favor." In Tibet, the laity are referred to as blackheads because they have hair on their heads. Monks, of course, have shaven heads. That evening at the service I was very attentive. I determined to work hard so that I should become a lama as soon as possible. Then I would stride among those blackheads and spurn them when they sought my services. I was indeed so attentive that I attracted the attention of a proctor. He regarded me with high suspicion, thinking such devotion from me was wholly unnatural. As soon as the service ended, I hurried away to my quarters as I knew I would have a busy day with the Lama Minya Dondup on the morrow. For some time I could not sleep. I tossed and turned and thought of the past and of the hardships I had undergone. In the morning I arose and had my breakfast and then was about to make my way to the Lama's quarters. As I was leaving the room, a hulking monk in a tattered robe grabbed me. "Hey, you," he said, "you work in the kitchen this morning, cleaning millstones too." "But sir," I replied, "my guide the Lama Minya Dondup wants me." I attempted to squeeze past. "No, you come with me. Doesn't matter who wants you, I say you are going to work in the kitchen." He grabbed my arm and twisted it so that I could not escape. Reluctantly I went with him, there was no choice. In Tibet we all took our turn at manual, at menial tasks. "Teaches humility," said one. "Prevents a boy from getting above himself," said another. "Knocks out class distinctions," said a third. "Boys, and monks, work at any task assigned purely as discipline." Of course, there was a domestic staff of lower grade monks, but boys and monks of all grades had to take turns at the lowest and most unpleasant tasks as training. We all hated it as the regulars, inferior men all, treated us as slaves, well knowing that we could not possibly complain. Complain? It was meant to be hard. Down the stone corridor we went. Down the steps made of two wooden uprights with bars fixed across. Into the great kitchens where I had been so badly burned on a leg. "There," said the monk who was holding me, "get up and clean out the grooves in the stones." Picking up a sharp metal spike, I climbed onto one of the great barley grinding wheels and industriously dug into the crushed debris lodged in the grooves. This stone had been neglected, and now, instead of grinding, it had just spoiled the barley. My task was to dress the surface so that it was again sharp and clean. The monk stood by, idly picking his teeth. "Hey," yelled a voice from the entrance, "Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. Is Tuesday Lobsang Rampa here? The Honorable Lama Minya Dondup wants him immediately." Instinctively I stood up and jumped off the stone. "Here I am," I called. The monk brought his belt fist down hard on the top of my head, knocking me to the ground. "I say you will stay here and do your work," he growled. "If anyone wants you, let him come in person." Catching me by the neck, he lifted me and flung me onto the stone. The world blank and dark. Strangely, I had a sensation of being lifted, lifted horizontally, and then stood on my feet. Somewhere a great deep toiled gong seemed to be tolling out the seconds of life. It went bong bong bong, and with a final stroke I felt that I had been struck by blue lightning. On the instant the world grew very bright, bright with a kind of yellowish light, a light in which I could see more clearly than normal. "Oh, oh," I said to myself, "so I am outside of my body. Lines of this old earth of ours, and I had traveled also to many of the greatest cities upon this globe. Now, though, I had my first experience of being jumped out of my body. I stood beside the great millstone looking down with considerable distaste at the scruffy little figure in the very tattered robe lying on the stone. I gazed down, and it was only a matter of passing interest to observe how my astral body was joined to that battered figure by a bluish-white cord which undulated and pulsed, which glowed brightly and faded, and glowed and faded again. Then I gazed more closely at my body upon this stone slab, and was appalled at the great gash over the left temple from whence oozed dark red blood, blood which seeped down into the stone grooves and mixed inextricably with the debris which so far had not been dug out. A sudden commotion attracted my attention, and as I turned I saw my guide, the Lama Minyadondup, entering the kitchen, his face white with anger. He strode forward and came to a halt right before the head monk of the kitchen, the monk who had treated me so badly. No word was spoken, no word at all, in fact there was a hushed and deathly silence. My guide's piercing eyes seemed to strike lightning into the kitchen monk. With a sigh like a punctured balloon he subsided into an inert mass on the stone floor. Without sparing a second glance at him my guide turned away, turned to my earthly figure stretched out, breathing stertorously upon that stone circle. I looked about me. I was really fascinated to think that I was now able to get out of my body for short distances. Going far travels in the astral was nothing, I always had been able to do that, but this sensation of getting out of myself and looking down upon my earthly suit of clay was a new, intriguing experience. Ignoring the happenings about me for a moment, I let myself drift up through the ceiling of the kitchen. "Ow!" I said involuntarily as I passed through the stone ceiling into the room above. Here were seated a group of lamas in deep contemplation. I saw with some interest that they had a sort of model of the world before them. It was a round ball upon which were indicated continents and lands and oceans and seas, and the round ball was fixed at an angle, the angle corresponding to the tilt of the earth itself in space. I did not tarry there, this seemed to me to be too much like lesson work. I journeyed upwards, through another ceiling, through another, and yet another, and then I stood in the room of the tombs. About me were the great golden walls which supported the tombs of the incarnations of the Dalai Lama for centuries past. I stood here in reverent contemplation for some moments, and then allowed myself to drift upwards, upwards, so that at last below me I saw that glorious Potala with all its gleaming gold, with all its scarlet and crimson, and with the wondrous white walls which seemed to melt into the living rock of the mountain itself. Turning my gaze slightly to the right I could see the village of Sho and beyond that the city of Lhasa with the blue mountains in the background. As I rose I could see the limitless spaces of our fair and pleasant land, a land which could be hard and cruel through the vagaries of unpredictable weather but which, to me, was home. A remarkably severe tugging attracted my attention and I found myself being reeled in as I often reeled in a kite which was soaring in the sky. I sank down and down, down into the potala, through floors which became ceilings, and through floors again, until at last I reached my destination and stood again beside my body in the kitchen. The Lama Minyadondup was gently bathing my left temple, picking pieces from it. "Good gracious!" I said to myself in profound astonishment, "is my head so thick that it cracked or chipped the stone?" Then I saw that I had a small fracture, I saw also a lot of the material being pulled from my head was debris, rubbish, the chippings of stone and the remnants of ground barley. I watched with interest, and, I confess, some amusement, for here standing beside my body in my astral body I felt no pain, no discomfort, only peace. At last the Lama Minyadondup finished his ministrations and he put a patch, a herbal compress, upon my head and bound it about with silken bonds. Then, Motioning to two monks who stood by with a litter, he instructed them to lift me so carefully. The men, monks of my own order, gently lifted me and placed me upon that litter with a lama miniatured up walking beside. I was carried off. I looked about me in considerable astonishment. The light was fading. Had I been so long that the day was dying? Before I had an answer to that, I found that I too was fading. The yellow and the blue of the spiritual light was diminishing in intensity, and I felt an absolutely overwhelming, absolutely overpowering urge to rest, to sleep and not to bother about anything. I knew no more for a time, and then, through my head shot excruciating pains, pains which caused me to see reds and blues and greens and yellows, pains which made me think that I should go mad with the intense agony. A cool hand was placed upon me and a gentle voice said, "It is all right, Lobsang. It is all right, rest, rest, go to sleep." The world seemed to become a dark fluffy pillow, the pillow was soft as swan's down into which I sank gratefully, peacefully, and the pillow seemed to envelop me so that I knew no more, and again my soul soared in space, while upon the earth my battered body remained at rest. It must have been many hours later when I again regained consciousness. I awakened to find my guide sitting beside me, holding my hands in his. As my eyelids fluttered upwards and the light of the evening streamed in, I smiled weakly, and he smiled back at me then, disengaging his hands. He took from a little table beside him a cup with some sweet-smelling brew. Gently pressing it to my lips, he said, "Drink this up, it will do you good." I drank, and life flooded through me once again, so much so that I tried to sit up. The effort was too much. I felt as if a great club had been bashed down once more upon my head. I saw vivid lights, constellations of lights, and I soon desisted in my efforts. The evening shadows lengthened, from below me came the muted sound of the conches, and I knew that the service was about to start. My guide, the Lama Miniadondup, said, "I have to go for half an hour, Lobsang, because the inmost one wants me, but your friends Timon and Yaljai are here to look after you in my absence and to call me should the occasion arise." He squeezed my hands, rose to his feet, and left the room. Two familiar faces appeared, half frightened and wholly excited. They squatted down beside me, and Timon said, "Oh, Lobsang. Did the kitchen master get a telling off about all this?" "Yes," said the other, "and he is being turned out of the Lamasery for extreme, unnecessary brutality. He is being escorted out now." They were bubbling with excitement, and then Timon said again, "I thought you were dead, Lobsang, you really did bleed like a stuffed yak." I really had to smile as I looked at them. Their voices showed how thrilled they were at any excitement to relieve the drab monotony of life in a Lamasery. I held no grudge against them for their excitement, knowing that I too would have been excited if the victim had been other than I. I smiled upon them and was then overpowered by an oppressive tiredness. I closed my eyes, intending to rest them for a few moments, and once again I knew no more. For several days, perhaps 7 or 8 in all, I rested upon my back, and my guide, the Lama Miniadondup, acted as my nurse, but for him I should not have survived, for life in a Lamasery is not necessarily gentle or kind, it is indeed survival of the fittest. The Lama was a kind man, a loving man, but even had he been otherwise there would have been the greatest reasons for keeping me alive. I, as I have said before, had a special task to do in life, and I suppose that the hardships which I was undergoing as a boy were meant in some way to toughen me, to make me become inured to hardship and suffering, for all the prophecies that I had heard, and I had heard quite a few, had indicated that my life would be a life of sorrow, a life of suffering. But it was not all suffering. As my condition improved there were more opportunities for talk with my guide. We talked of many things. We covered common subjects and we covered subjects which were most uncommon. We dealt at length with various occult subjects. I remember on one occasion saying, "It must be a wonderful thing, Honorable Lama, to be a librarian and so possess all the knowledge in the world. I would be a librarian were it not for all these terrible prophecies as to my future." My guide smiled down upon me. "The Chinese have a saying, 'A picture is worth 1,000 words.' Lobsang, but I say that no amount of reading nor looking at pictures will replace practical experience and knowledge. I looked at him to see if he was serious, and then I thought of the Japanese monk, Kenji Tekaki, who for almost 70 years had studied the printed word and had failed to practice or to absorb anything that he had read. My guide read my thoughts. Yes,